Hello, I'm Father Mitch Paquin. Welcome to EWTN Live, where we bring you guests from around the world. Now, our guest tonight says that without man and woman, the human race does not exist. And without the capacity for truth, we are not really human. So in the face of increasing public acceptance of transgender identities, same-sex marriage and non-marital relationships, surrogate parenthood, widespread use of contraception, and all sorts of other things, we need to recall who we are and what we are as sexual human beings. Here to help us examine that is our guest tonight. He's a professor from Thomas Aquinas College in Santa Paula, California. He's also the co-author and the editor of a book called Sexual Identity, The Harmony of Philosophy, Science, and Revelation. So please welcome our guest, Dr. John D. Finley. Dr. Finley, welcome. Good
Thanks,
to
Father.
Have you.
Great to be here.
Thank you very much. You actually were a student at University of Dallas when I was teaching there.
That's right.
But different department and such.
Yeah, philosophy.
Yeah, you're in philosophy, yeah. And I was teaching in a different master's program. And, you know, this is part of the quest for you, as I understand, that what kind of philosophy did you focus on studying when you were in grad school?
Yeah, so my primary focus was the thought of Thomas Aquinas, the great medieval philosopher and theologian. And then I studied a fair bit of phenomenology as well.
Yes.
So the tradition of philosophy that John Paul II came out of and that Edith Stein was an earlier practitioner of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, just about 3 weeks ago, I was in her home city. Today it's called Wrocław. It was Breslau in her times. Studying her and doing a documentary on her. We'll have that in a few months. But I think it's, as I read your book, I could detect the influence of that school of philosophy. Now, this is your background. You're not a scientist, correct?
That's right.
And you're not a theologian.
Nope.
But this book seeks to bring together your field of philosophy, thinking about the very nature of being man and woman, as well as the science and the faith aspect, the religious revelation aspect. Would that be correct?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The tradition of education that I'm acquainted with at the University of Dallas and with teaching at Thomas Aquinas College values an approach that takes seriously the contributions of these different areas of study, the sciences, as well as philosophy, literature, and theology.
Yeah.
And when I was researching this question on what it is to be male and female from a philosophical point of view, I realized that we need an engagement with science because there's so much to be discovered and so much we can discover about ourselves at from the genetic level all the way up. But then along with that is the fact that obviously our sexuality, to be male, to be female, is something that characterizes our whole being, our whole personhood, whether it be at the chromosomal level, but also it affects our behavior, our relationships, our vocations as mother and father, and the way in which we image God, right? So all these different areas of study need to come together to be able to give us a robust understanding of ourselves.
And at the same time, we live at a time when a lot of folks would certainly be very angry about introducing religious aspects of gender identity. And they really can get pretty testy, if not outright angry, about philosophy. They only want to use science, and even then, only some of the science. I mean, last year I had a scientist who, an endocrinologist, pediatric endocrinologist, studies the hormone system
and,
of the human body. and the most complex system of the whole body. And he's not allowed to even publish scientific facts that contradict what other scientists have made into an ideology on sexual identity. So yeah. This is where we're challenging a certain type of edited, limited use of science that's out there with political agendas.
That's right. So we do have the great gift as Catholic Christians of revelation, mm-hmm. right? Which contains the depth and the breadth of God's wisdom, and especially looking to Genesis, to the scriptures, but to the wealth of church teaching, especially from John Paul II on this subject of man and woman. But it's the same God who created the natural world, who created us. And so we have every right to be able to look into these different areas and to try and wrestle with these questions by availing ourselves of what real science has to say that can complement what we read in the scriptures.
Well, I'd like to quote from your book on sexual identity. And it says, in reality, science is one important piece of the integral whole that is wisdom, which also includes philosophy, great literature, and divine revelation. And we need to recall that we are the originators of science and technology, that they exist to serve our goals, and that we find ourselves stunted to the extent that we accept scientific conclusions that don't fit with what we recognize to be true. You know, that, and there's even one, I remember one place where one, I think it might have been the president, we want data, not truth, or yeah. something along that line. No, we want data that is true and in a true context.
Yeah, and the point about technology is so important because it's a large part of the reason as to why we're in some of the situations.
So? What's technology doing to cause problems for our civilization in the sexual identity area?
Well, so it's similar to science, the science that makes technology possible. Mm-hmm. It's a good in itself, but it opens these possibilities that human beings had never dreamed of before, mm-hmm. right? So we can change so much about our physicality, and one could well wonder, well, why not change my gender, my sexuality, if I'm not comfortable with it? Mm-hmm. And we're able to do things at the level of surrogacy, and perhaps artificial wombs are coming in the future. Mm-hmm. All these elements that have to do with reproduction, with the sexual dimension of being human, are being affected by technology. And so it just pushes the question in many people's minds, well, why not? Mm-hmm. Why not mess with the biology?
Well, what's the answer? Why not? Why yeah. don't we do that?
Right.
And by the way, just so folks know, you yourself are a married man and the father of three.
I am, yes. I have a wonderful, beautiful wife and three lovely children.
So you've got some background in this area. What is it? Why not use all this technology to do as we please?
Well, two things. First of all, it's impossible to literally change our sexuality, right? And this is a testament to how thoroughgoing a feature it is of our humanness, right? Once again, our sexuality characterizes us at the genetic and chromosomal level. Every cell in our body is marked by the XX or the XY chromosome.
XX is a chromosome in?
The female.
In XY?
In the male.
There you go.
That's right.
Can you change, if you have a sex change operation, does your cellular structure change?
No, and that's why it was so important that we had a plastic surgeon among our co-authors,
yes.
Dr. Patrick Lappert, a wonderful man,
he
wonderful
really
Catholic.
Is. Yes.
And his chapter, in disturbing detail, shows what these surgeries, these sex transition surgeries involve, and it's a real mutilation of the person. Mm-hmm. Of course it doesn't change our genetics. It can't. It leaves us wounded. It leaves the person, when we're talking about the most radical surgeries, infertile. So we're actually talking about a loss of a beautiful, fundamental human capacity.
Yeah.
Right? Even if the person were to never go on and have kids, many people don't throughout history, right? But to be aware of the fact that they possess this gift is a marvelous thing.
It is. Let me quote from Dr. Patrick Lappert, who's in your book, contributed one of the articles. He wrote, "Transgender surgery has its foundational principle, the idea that it is legitimate to utterly destroy a human capacity, in this case, the reproductive capacity, for the sake of producing a counterfeit structure in order to satisfy a subjective desire." In other words, mm-hmm. if somebody personally feels, well, I desire to be the other sex, that's just how I feel. So I want to change, but I have to destroy my reproductive abilities in order to make that change.
Yeah.
So that a woman will never be able to have babies if she has these radical surgeries, and a man will never be able to have children if he has the radical surgeries. That you can't.
That's right. And one of the stunning things about this phenomenon is that it's the only time in history where you've had, on the basis of a purely subjective self-diagnosis, the allowance for a person to so radically hinder themselves, mutilate themselves.
Yes.
Right. Now, of course, we have experiences and thoughts and feelings regarding ourselves all the time. That's just part of the human condition. But we also know that our own subjective feelings are no guarantee of what's actually the case. Right? If I feel like I should be in charge at work, that doesn't make me the boss.
No.
Nor should it.
No.
Right? And so that's another reason why the psychological dimension of this is so important, is that we need to be able to ask the person, what is it that you're really struggling with? What's the suffering here? How can we help you?
Yeah, because we're not saying that they're not suffering.
Right.
They're undergoing a real difficulty.
Yeah.
And that's an important fact to examine and respect them, but having them mutilate themselves doesn't come across to me as respect, especially if it destroys their capacity as a human being to reproduce.
That's right. It's a tough situation that we're in as a society, because so many things have happened that kind of make the transgender movement kind of a one more logical domino in a whole series, right? So you've got a proliferation of pornography, the legalization of no-fault divorce, the acceptance of in vitro fertilization, not to mention abortion, right? So all these problems that in some way or another attack the sexual nature of ourselves and weaken the man-woman relationship that finally finds its fulfillment in marriage. Mm-hmm. So, and then hypersexualized images of men and women broadcast by advertisements and commercials and media for the last many decades.
Plus a very significant industry in pornography that takes even what goes on in the sexualized advertising a whole new level of self-destruction. I mean, yeah. I've spoken to a urologist locally who's treating people that are so addicted to pornography that they also lose their sexual function.
Wow.
You know, this is a serious problem.
Yeah.
We are not making people happy by following their feelings, and that's where philosophy comes in this whole equation. Philosophy helps us think through these issues as well as analyze our feelings.
That's absolutely right. And originally I thought it would be a good thing to start the book with a biology chapter so mm-hmm. we get the facts on the ground, science. But then I realized, no, science is specialized. It's technical, mm-hmm. right? What we need to start with is the philosophical point of view, kind of an everyman's philosophy along the lines of what you might find from C.S. Lewis or G.K. Chesterton, right? Mm-hmm. Not technical language, but look, we have the ability to think about ourselves and the world around us what do we notice about what it is to be man and woman? There's a lot we can get if we just take the time to self-reflect a little bit on what we already experience.
But that's one of the points that your book makes. I forget which article this was discussed, but humans alone, of all the animals, are capable of thinking about their sexuality. Animals respond to hormonal changes at the different seasons mm-hmm. of the year, depending on the kind of animal it is. And they breed, and they give birth, and they nurse their young if they're mammals, and then they kick them off. Yeah. You know, this is a cycle, you know, I've seen lots in nature.
Right.
We have a whole other level of reflection on, you know, what it means to raise a child for 18 or 20 years, yeah. Sometimes more, and what it means to be with a spouse, not just a mate, you know, for many years more than that. These are all very significant human thoughts that the animals, they don't share that with us.
That's right, and that's a testament to a theme that you find developed in John Paul II, that there is a way in which our very structure as man and woman is part of the manner in which we image God mm-hmm. as a communion
yes.
of persons.
Yes.
And so it's true. Our sexuality is always there for us as a reality or a potential reality to be exercised in a way that it isn't for any other animal.
Yes.
And marriage is meaningful beyond the fertile times of life. And we are able to reflect on the fact that we're meant for self-transcendence. We're meant to be able to give ourselves in love to others. That's what the human calling is, and we find that most visibly the case in marriage. And you don't have to be a Catholic theologian or even a Catholic believer to get that. People have been married and raised kids for centuries, and it's natural to us to sacrifice on behalf of others and those we love and to be faithful.
And there's also another component. It is part of the reality of fallen human beings to make mistakes and to become selfish at times as parents. Children, of course, have, you know, their own, you know, immediacies that tend to have them in their world of themselves. And but even parents can at times fail and become self-centered and be sometimes even harmful in that self-centeredness. Sometimes they're trying to do what is good and their goodness isn't focused on the object of love, the child that they love, and they mess up. But they can also make corrections.
Yeah.
That's the other side of being human. It's possible to mess up. It's also possible to correct. And that is part of the message that y'all have in your book about sexual identity.
That's right.
There are things that you can mess up because of, you know, our sinfulness, our fallen nature, but these can be corrected.
Yeah, so you take the biological level. Obviously, since we're composed of materiality, things can and do go wrong. You can have people who are born with a chromosomal condition that results in some ambiguity in their biological sex. Mm-hmm. And that's a real challenge for that
sure.
person, right?
Absolutely.
At the same time, because of the thing you're talking about, you can have someone who's been deeply wounded by the way in which others have treated them, maybe even a case of abuse. And that person is going to struggle with his or her sexuality in an entirely different way, even if their biology is utterly fine.
Yes.
And so again, it's a reality that affects us at these many levels. And this is part of why we need to be cognizant of that and like you say, acknowledge the suffering that people have gone through in some of these difficult mm-hmm. cases and help them in love to live into truth. Because yeah. because we are all capable of that.
Yeah. And, you know, there's so many elements to look at, but, you know, part of our tasks in families is to help the children not just pick a gender. This has become a certain fear that I can't impose, you know, what the gender my child might be. Yeah. You know, you didn't choose their XX or XY genes. You'll choose whether you get Levi's or some other genes. But those genes, you had no choice.
Right.
That happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something where you then deal with the person that comes to you in birth. You know, I've never had kids, but I sure know lots of kids over the years. They come into this world with a personality already.
Yeah.
You don't create their personality.
That's right.
And you're forming and reacting to them. Same with their sexuality.
Yeah, exactly. And you see there this development of the person alongside of their sexuality, that from even in the womb, just as there's a personality that's present, maybe an active baby versus a less active one, you also have the sexuality that's present in that little person very, very early on. Mm-hmm. But then it needs to be cultivated. The person will grow physically, but we also have to nurture and guide and educate this person.
Yes.
And that's a huge dimension of human sexuality, is what can be formed by the child's loved ones,
yes.
Parents, siblings, teachers, mentors, right? And so that then we're looking at the realm of culture. And what so often happens is that people, and you hear this from many voices within the transgender movement, is that they effectively reduce what it means to be male or female to these cultural accidental forms and practices. Like, well, I must be a woman because I enjoy wearing pants of a certain color or wearing my hair short. I'm sorry, I must be a man because I enjoy these types of things. Of course, that's just a succumbing to a very superficial, purely cultural reality.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we need to recognize there are also cultural realities that speak deeply to what it is to be man or woman, like respect for pregnant women.
Yeah.
Right? Parenthood, sexual intercourse, pregnancy, these are all cultural realities, and you find them across human history, across the globe. And those should be recognized for what they are. They speak to something true about us. At the same time, we have a host of cultural practices that are much more transient, and if you want to wear pink and I want to wear blue, okay.
Yeah, that my superiors wouldn't like that. This is, you know, I always tell folks, my mom has died, I don't have a wife, this is the way I get my clothes to match.
Lovely.
But that brings up something else that, as you're speaking, you know, I'm sure you've observed, you can't help but observe with your children, that there are times each child will just want to cling to their mother.
Hmm.
And then that changes, and they want to cling to their dad.
Yeah.
And they just want to do it, and then they go back. And because that relationship, and there's a sexual component in those relationships, obviously, the difference between male and female in mom and dad, that going back and forth is part of that helping them come to who they are. Whether it's a little girl or a little boy, they go back and forth and learn about their sexuality and their parents' sexuality as they go from one parent to another.
Yeah, that's so true. And you see these marvelous ways in which the differences of the man and woman, the differences of the mother and father contribute, sometimes very distinctly, and sometimes in ways that we only over time appreciate from each other, but to the children's identity and their upbringing. Mm-hmm. And that's something that would be terrible to lose. If you were to imagine the way males react to certain situations, if that's all you had, right? Or the way females react to certain situations, if that's what's all you had, you'd have a really impoverished world.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I oftentimes point out that, you know, moms will talk to their children and hold them. And it's just, I don't know why we do it. Nobody tells us to do this, but men just have an instinct to take their babies after they're about 10 months old and toss them in the air,
right,
driving their poor mothers crazy. What are you doing? And the baby is laughing his head off.
Yeah.
You know, as you, presumably when you catch them, but but it's a man, the dad teaches the baby to take a risk. I'll catch you.
Yeah.
Mom teaches a security, and this is instinctual to men and women.
Right.
We just do it.
Right. And they're both crucial for
exactly.
a human life. You need
exactly.
to know you're loved, and you need to be capable of
risk.
Challenge
yeah.
and risk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is that complementarity that builds a child's identity.
Right, right. Yeah, and that was where the chapter on psychology written by Dr. Andrew Sodergren, it was so important.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, number one, some of these issues, like the transgender issue, does have a lot to do with what's going on psychologically in a person's
yes.
life.
Right? Yes.
But number two, it's where you find some of the most interesting, typical differences between men and women. We're only talking generalizations here.
Yeah.
But there are so many interesting ones, right? Even the way in which men and women tend to approach religion and God mm-hmm. just slightly differently. Or there's a famous one where they looked at young human males and young human females, and the males were drawn to toys that were more mechanical, the females drawn to toys that were more personal, like dolls. And someone raised the objection, well, maybe that's just cultural conditioning, but they had done the study with young primates too, young monkeys, and they showed the exact same difference.
Yeah, yeah.
And fascinating.
By age 4 months, a difference in desire to verbalize starts showing up. Mm. And little, I don't know if you have girls, boys?
Yeah, both.
Both, yeah.
Right.
And, you know, that little girls will talk in their play. They'll carry on conversations for
right.
10, 12 bears, dolls, and whatever they got.
Yeah.
Boys make noises.
Mm.
You know, they're planes, trains, guns, bombs, cars. We make noises when we play.
Right.
And I've often thought this is part of our instinct to hunt. That, you know, hunters always imitate the sounds of their environment.
Mm.
In a modern environment, we boys imitate the sounds of the machines around us.
Yeah.
That's just what we do. You know, we
right.
want to be good at it.
Yeah, yeah.
God. We impress each other how well we make sounds that are just like that object.
That's right, yeah. God values that.
Yeah.
He somehow wanted that.
Yeah.
He wanted both.
Yeah. And these are complementary differences.
That's right. Yeah, so when we looked at the biological chapter, and that was Dr. Kara Busk-Miller mm-hmm. and Dr. Paul Hrues, a pediatric endocrinologist,
mm-hmm.
it was amazing to see one of the things they mention in the chapter is that even when it comes to the biological level, there are whole textbooks written on what they call gender-specific medicine. Namely, aside from our reproductive system, the number of diseases and conditions that have to be treated differently in men versus women. Because, once again, the sexual aspect of ourselves, even biologically, runs through our whole organism.
Yeah.
And so you start messing with one realm of the body, you don't know what else you're going to impact.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is the point that Dr. Quentin Van Meter had made last year on this program.
Mm.
And it's, you know, people are surprised, they don't like to hear it, but transgender, or people who go through transgender changes, surgical changes, and start getting the hormones, have a life expectancy 50% shorter than the average.
Wow.
And they don't say that.
Right.
They don't tell you that in the news stories. but you cut their life expectancy down to about 40 instead of the normal 80.
It's terrible.
And my dad was a mechanic for a lot of years, and it just reminded me of putting gasoline into a diesel engine or diesel fuel into a gas engine. Neither one's going to work.
That's right.
You can't mix and match hormones when every cell is XX, like it was born, or XY, like it was born.
Yeah, so you have these devastating consequences at the level of the organism, like you're talking about, but then you've got devastating consequences psychologically, too. And this is where you find so many people now, they're referred to as the detransitioners, who have attempted to find their way back with the help of medicine to what they originally were. And a lot of the time, it can only be partial because so much damage has been done.
Exactly. And as a result, there's a high suicide rate among those who do transition, 42%, indicating that that doesn't really help. The transitioning did not help. And this is highly problematic. I'm afraid we have to take a break. We're done with this part of the segment, but we'd like to open it up for some of your questions and comments on sexual identity and the role that philosophy, science, and faith all play in that. So please stay with us. Welcome back. We are discussing a book called Sexual Identity, The Harmony of Philosophy, Science, and Revelation. It is written and edited by our guest, Dr. John D. Finley, PhD. And if you'd like to get a copy, it is available at ewtnrc.com, and it is item number A284. It would be well worth it, and especially in these times where a lot of questions are raised, this may be useful. Ready for some questions?
Sounds good.
Let's start off with Steve in the great state of Oregon. Steve, what can we do for you today?
Yes, Father, I got a question. It says, a man wants to be a woman, and he's attracted to men. How can he overcome these feelings?
Okay, how can he overcome the feelings of being attracted to men?
Yes, and he wants to be a woman.
Mm-hmm. So becoming a woman is his way of trying to overcome those feelings?
Yes.
Okay, good. Just so I have Claire. Yeah. Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, so a couple things that come to mind. So first of all, again, to talk about a man becoming a woman, we're only ever going to be talking about something that's artificial, that's forced, that's fraught with difficulty, even on the physical level, not to mention the emotional level. Mm-hmm. And so this person won't become a woman in the true sense of the word, and therefore won't be capable of having the kind of relationship that a man and a woman truly could have. So it seems to me that that's going to be a failed effort. But the second thing to say, there's something understandable with this person, right? Something we can relate to and sympathize with, that this is a man attracted to men and he wants to be a woman attracted to a man, right? He wants the attraction to be heterosexual, which we would say is what's natural and the way God intends things. We have to remember that for all that sexuality is a very important part of our lives and our personhood, sexuality is not the end-all be-all. It's not the most important thing about us. Right? The most important thing about us is that we're human and that we're created into through the love of God to image Him. Yes. And so many people have gone through life struggling with different feelings, different attractions. Many people have gone through life never embarking on a sexual relationship, right? And this is possible for the human being. This is part of what it means to be human, is that our sexuality, it's both a gift given to us, but it's also something we freely choose to exercise or not. And so I would say that this man needs to be encouraged to live a human life, but that doesn't have to involve sexual relationship. That's a real possibility for any one of us.
And I would also add, if he's craving this, having this strong attraction to other men, I would wonder if there is a missing component of male affection that isn't itself, you know, genitally and sexually expressed. That there's, you know, men and women show a lot of affection and care for the people of the same sex without it becoming a sexual relationship.
Yeah.
Fathers, you know, affection with their sons is something that they hold them, they bathe them, there are all sorts of, you know, very intimate contacts. They teach them potty training, and they also do all kinds of other activities that, you know, a playing ball and roughhousing, wrestling. There's a wide variety of ways of male emotional expression that a lot of young men are missing.
Yeah.
When they don't have a father in the house at all, which is a higher percentage today than it ever has been, and or their father doesn't get them. The father doesn't connect them. He wanted another kind of son, or wanted a daughter, or whatever. And this is where dads also have to say, you get the person you get,
right?
And you learn how to deal with that individual. You may want a really great athlete, but you have someone who's interested in art. You develop it.
Yeah.
You know, you deal with that kid. If he wants to play the violin, get him a garage and get him a violin to play it in, you know, so he doesn't drive the house nuts. But you deal with these things.
Yeah.
And show the affection. And that may be more what this man is needing. And that, because I certainly in counseling, I notice that the sexualization of that desire for male relationships and friendship gets destroyed, the sexualizing of it destroys the friendship and the love. It makes it something that it's not supposed to be, whereas there is real male friendship and, you know, doing things together, and that's very affectionate in its own way. But it's not, you know, and this guy sounds like he might be missing that. And that's why you don't just say, well, I reject you because you have the same sex attraction. No, a dad needs to love his son all the more.
Yeah.
And help him deal with the affection. You don't approve of bad behavior, but you love your son all the more and show him more tenderness. I think that's a very important element too.
Absolutely, yeah.
We have another caller. Paul, where are you calling from?
Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Good to have you. They call that the area. So, Paul,
yes,
what can we do for you?
My question was, Father, where the church is like, you know, our popes, our cardinals, our bishops, and our priests standing up for our children, getting castrated, mutilating their bodies, destroying them psychologically. They're in such danger now, and we have supposedly a Catholic president that's promoting all this. Where is our church leadership?
Yeah, so I hear the question. I hear that you're upset about this, and I sympathize with it. There is has been a lack of what we'd hope to hear from many pastors. At the same time, there have been some things put out, even at the level of the Vatican, but also from the United States mm-hmm. Conference of Bishops, that have been very good on this issue. And one area where they've made some interventions has been with the medical systems. And so you see there are actually a number of dioceses whose bishops have written some kind of a statement on precisely this issue, primarily the transgender issue, and are making people aware of the fact that this is grave harm that's being done, mm-hmm. and that medical practitioners in good conscience, especially if they call themselves Catholic, can't be doing this. There are a number of those statements that have been put out by various dioceses over the past few years.
Pope Francis himself has spoken out on this for a number of years.
Yep.
But I think, Paul, that there's also a fear of reaction to, you know, if you speak critically, you will be called homophobic, transphobic, and they don't just mean that you're afraid. It's just in a society that uses very naughty language all the time, and uses very naughty language like punctuation. The last dirty words are about being called a racist, transgender, phobic, or homophobic. Those are the last dirty words, and you have activists who are well-financed that want to cause trouble. And frankly, I think a lot of people in politics, as well as in business and in the church, are afraid to speak up. That's sometimes the case. Not everybody, by any means, but that is the case.
Yeah, especially people, I admire so much the people in the medical industries who do speak the truth on mm-hmm. these issues, because they are putting their jobs on the line.
They are. And they get canceled. You know, some of them, like Dr. Van Meter, is not allowed to publish in many journals anymore.
Right.
You know, that's just the reality.
Yes. It's also the case that now is a very important time for especially lay people in the church who are philosophers, who are scientists, who are medical practitioners, to take the initiative and help their pastors with this stuff.
Yes.
Because a pastor of a parish is not necessarily, very unlikely, to be an expert in any one of these fields. Mm-hmm. He's got a million things going on, and he needs the help of people, thoughtful people in his parish, to be able to come mm-hmm. forward and say, look, why don't we say something here? Let's be proactive and distill the church's teaching mm-hmm. Before some crisis arises, and then we're in a reactionary mode. Mm-hmm. And that's when things don't get done well.
And I think another thing too, Paul, is we've seen in churches, various activists will try to disrupt and, you know, take over the liturgy. And you're talking about people who have no compunction about committing sacrilege against the Blessed Sacrament or the church itself. They have none. And, you know, if the priests stand up, then the laity have to be there to say, we will stand up to defend Holy Mass and the Blessed Sacrament, and at times the priests and the nuns. You know, that's just part of the reality, because this can be pretty nasty at times, as we see in the political realm, but also it happens mm-hmm. in churches.
Yeah.
So that's another side of this too. We have Laura calling in. Laura, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Spokane, Washington.
Good to have you here. Thank you. And what's your question?
I have a cousin who is transgender, and I was just wondering, is it okay to still call her by her birth name? as some of her sisters use her birth name, and some of them use her the name that she has chosen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for that question.
It's Laura, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Laura, I think that that particular question is a prudential matter. So if the person is so adamant about this, and it seems to make a huge difference, and there's no way to have a relationship unless you use the name of their preference, well, maybe someone could discern that that's the way to go. I certainly think it's fine, though, on the other hand, to use the name of their birth, because that does hearken to the truth. It hearkens better to the truth of who they are. So I would definitely, in direct response to your question, say yes, that's okay. But I do think that these sorts of questions have to be handled very prudentially, because you're not talking about affirming or not affirming their actual status as transgender. Okay, that would be a different sort of matter. You're not being asked to do that. When you're talking about the choice of a name, that's a more superficial thing.
And because it's a family member, I think to engage that person in a serious discussion, you know, here's why I like using your name. I'm not trying to be political with you or obnoxious. You're my cousin. I've loved you since we've known each other. And, you know, I really like who you are as whatever the name might be. And talk to her about it and just let her know that you're not trying to be obnoxious. You're in fact being cherishing her as you know her.
Right.
But see how that discussion goes, because, again, it's prudential, too.
Yeah.
We have Kathy on the line. Kathy, what can we do for you?
Hi, I'm Kathy. I have a 24-year-old child who was born a girl. Her name was Rebecca, and she's transitioning into a young man. She wants to go by Elias, and I'm the mom, and because I said to her at one time that God doesn't make mistakes, that you were born a girl for a reason, that there's a reason that you were born this way. And because I said that, she has cut me out of their life. I'm not allowed to talk to that child. I'm not allowed to be around that child. And I don't know. I pray on this constantly. What else is there that I can do besides pray?
First of all, really sorry to hear that. This is the pain of a lot of parents, and I'm really sorry to hear that. But Dr. Wood, how would you respond?
Yes, Kathy, this is so difficult. I can't imagine what you're going through.
Yeah.
I would say I don't have direct experience with this kind of thing, especially as a parent, the way you're having now. But it sounds like you're not able to be in any kind of a relationship with her right now. But so aside from praying, as you're doing, and realizing that Christ himself took up his cross and is always with us, even in these most difficult trials, I think reading on your own some of the different facets of what's going into situations like this. And there aren't a ton of resources yet, but they have been coming out, different books church documents on this issue, trying to get maybe more of a holistic sense of the different possibilities as to what might be going on with your child. And talking, if you can, to yourself, to good, maybe even Catholic counselors, to get their take on what some of the possibilities could be here. Because to the extent that you can maybe grow in some understanding of what's occurring with your child, that may help you, and it might make you more ready for when there can be a relationship in the future to be able to assist in the ways that you can offer. So I think right now, yeah, you're not able to force a relationship, but you can do things for yourself to be ready for when that moment occurs. Father, do you have anything?
I was also going to say, you also need to be with people that you love and who love you, and maybe even talk to a counselor or psychologist to help you sort through these reactions you're having, to help you understand. Just looking at it from what little that you've said, your daughter is trying to harm you. She's trying to hurt your feelings, and she's succeeding. It hurts. Obviously, it's in your voice. It's in your question. It's very painful for you. And I would suggest she wants you to feel pain. And she's inflicting that on you on purpose because she's got her own issues of anger. And I don't know what those might be, but I would guarantee that she feels a lot of anger and she's taking it out on you by, you know, separating from you, and you obviously love her very much. I would suspect that there's a love lurking inside of her yet, but her anger has taken over. And you need to find people that you can work with and talk to who understand you and what you're going through. And pray for her, yeah. And I'd pray with some other people. You know, being isolated from your daughter and from your friends on the topic is not going to help you. Your daughter can definitely, be prayed for, but she cause you pain and all this isolation. But you can't afford to be isolated. Deal with other folks who care for you. That's going to be key. And in your own love of Christ, you know, to get closer to Him and our Blessed Mother, so that in that relationship too, you find great support as your daughter tries to hurt your feelings by isolating you, was saying something that, you know, you said, look, I love you the way you are. Well, I don't, and you can't love me, and I won't love you. That's what I mean by she's obviously hurting you. This is where you find other people and that become a source of strength. And as you get stronger in your relationship with Christ, you will become a focus that attracts your daughter back to you. So you chasing her, she'll want to come back to you. This is going to mess up. This transsexual surgeries and stuff messes a person up badly. And you strengthening yourself will make you a source of strength when she does want to come back to you. I have little doubt that she will. I want to just, again, encourage our audience to take a look at your book if this is an issue that they're concerned with. It's called Sexual Identity, The Harmony of Philosophy, Science, and Revelation. It's by our guest, Dr. John D. Finley, Ph.D., and it is item A284. It's available at ewtnrc.com. Thank you for coming all this way from Santa Paula, California, to be with us. I appreciate it. And may the Lord bless all of you, bless all those who are struggling with sexual identity and transitioning, and all these difficult situations. May the Lord bless you and keep you and cause His face to shine upon you and lead you in all of your ways by His peace. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
And we can approach this very important but sometimes difficult topic and so many other issues only because this network is brought to you by you. So please remember to keep us in between your gas bill, your electric bill, and your cable bill, and we'll be able to pay our bills too. God bless you, and thank you.
Thanks.